Welcome to Sideways Boulevard, where three Kansas City horror authors get together and talk about the weird stuff that they love to find on the interwebs and all around in this world. I'm Mark L. Groves, Shelby Dollar, and J.E. Peterson were not able to join me for this one because I recorded these podcasts live at the KC Spirit and Paranormal Convention in Kansas City in mid-March. Not only did I get to sell books, which you can find, by the way, on Amazon.com, just look up Magnificent Cowlick Media, plug, 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 thank you. I also had the opportunity to interview a number of the vendors that were out there. And by vendors, I mean people presenting. So I got to talk to a couple of mediums. I talked to a gentleman who wrote some books about Bigfoot. Talked to another gentleman who gets together with a group of people and contacts aliens through astral projection and more. So much fun. So good. And many, many thanks to KC Spirit and Paranormal Convention, and specifically April and Bettina, who made all of this possible. Y'all rock. Anyway, let's get into it. Here is the third podcast recorded live at the KC Spirit and Paranormal Convention with Sideways Boulevard.
If you've ever been to St. Joseph, Missouri, back when this podcast was called Pondstein's Lab, J.E. and Shelby and I stayed overnight in the Glor Psychiatric Museum, which is a fascinating learning experience and spooky as heck. But I may have to up the bar here. Sitting next to me right now is Marianne Podrasky, who is an investigator and a psychic medium, and also works with the historic and haunted Beatty Mansion. So welcome to Sideways Boulevard, Marianne.
Why, thank you, Mark.
The let's find out a little bit about the Beatty Mansion. Now, you can go to thebeattymansion.com, B-E-A-T-T-I-E mansion.com. It's located on 1120 Main Street in St. Joseph. And I love your website where it says it's the house on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of my favorite Netflix series. And yours seems to resemble it. Tell us about the history of this Beatty Mansion.
Well, she was built, and I call her she because she's decidedly feminine to me, but she was built in 1854 for Eliza and Armstrong Beatty. They originally started in Columbia, Missouri, and they wound up in St. Joseph, where he quickly became a fixture in politics.
Uh-huh.
He was a congressman first. I'm sorry, not a congressman, a committee person, and on the council, and then became mayor five times,
well,
which is a lot.
So he was strangely popular.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about some other things, and I don't want to foreshadow too quickly, probably not always the kindest man in the world, and especially for the time, we're talking the 1840s, 1850s, so there was a whole different world going on in that whole area at the time, and especially in Missouri versus Kansas. But with the Beatty Mansion itself, so he built this mansion as a home, correct?
Yes, a home for him and his wife. They had planned to have multiple children. That never happened. So they took in nieces and nephews and integrated the men into the banking business as well. He was also one of the first owners of a bank, actually had a bank named after him.
Oh, wow.
And was one of the first millionaires in St. Joseph.
But at the time, a millionaire is like a gazillionaire in today's dollars.
And that made you powerful,
oh,
of course. And it also made you important and bumped up everybody's ideal of who you are.
So you've got this man who is a his own kind of industry.
Mm-hmm.
He's wanted to have children, cannot have children, brought in family members. He was also a slave owner and had you talked about there was a register.
Mm-hmm.
That
census.
And it listed the people in the house. Or let me rephrase that. It listed the owner and his family in the house. How did it list the other 15 individuals?
As ages, date of birth, where they were born, and their race. The slaves never had names, and it was called the slave schedule.
Ugh,
for the
awful
for the census.
Yeah,
so,
and just amazing that this type of history, that it exists, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But the Beatty Mansion itself, there was decline in the family. Who did it move on to next?
After Armstrong died in 1878, it went to Eliza. She inherited the house all the property in it, but no money to run it. So, yeah, no money to run it. Everything, all the money went to the nieces, nephews, and a couple of other people that he did business with. But she died 2 years after him. She was bedridden and died basically waiting to die, really, honestly.
Yeah, kind of hoping to do yeah. after your husband jacked you up like
yeah.
that.
Well, they took over the house, the nieces and nephews, and they also had married. The girls had married in the house, but they took it over, sold it immediately, left town, and didn't even buy markers for Armstrong and Eliza.
They're in unmarked graves.
They're not now. They
oh,
were.
Okay.
They were.
Holy
for,
cow. That's almost Potter's
yeah,
Field.
Yeah. They were for a long time unmarked. And actually, the grass was overgrown around it.
Wow.
There's an article at the mansion about the Armstrong Beatty's ghost roaming the streets because it was unmarked.
Oh,
because his grave
wow.
was unmarked, yeah. But now he's roaming the Beatty Mansion. I don't know about the streets.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, wait yeah. till we get to this. This is going to be amazing. Yeah. So yeah. They sell it, and what does it become?
It becomes an orphanage. The Ladies Union Benevolent Association bought it and opened up an orphanage immediately after the Civil War ended.
Right.
And it became a place for displaced children and their mothers. And it was an orphanage for, oh gosh, a long time. I'm drawing a blank on the years, but enough so that they opened another annex, doubling the size of the building.
Wow.
And that's how full it was of children.
Ugh.
And it was an orphanage for a long time. And then it became a home for the elderly and aged and displaced. And it was a nursing home for a very long time. And then it became a place, kind of depository for people with social ills, if you
uh-huh.
will.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, after that was over, it became a halfway house for drug and alcohol people. So you have all these layers, all these different shifts
yes.
in functionality, and they're all, it's like paranormal soup.
I can't even imagine after, because I'm sure there were stories where people were able to come in and kind of pull themselves around, but so much anguish in the meantime is going to leave some stains,
mm-hmm.
I would think some energy stains.
Oh, absolutely.
But we get to all this, and then when did it just get shut down and become an empty kind of derelict
place? Well, it was a halfway house all the way up until, and some pretty gamey people, by the way, up until 1994, and then it sat empty for quite a while. And then it was bought by Michael Burkert, and he wanted to put a bed and breakfast in.
Oh, yeah, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It gets bought. Somebody has this kind of vision, and I love people who do this, by the
mm-hmm.
way. Let's turn it into a bed and breakfast. And he's bringing in contractors. What was the problem with that?
Well, they couldn't keep track of their tools, and a couple of them ran out of there because people were walking through walls.
So they're experiencing paranormal activity.
Well, they're banging. You can imagine they're tearing stuff up and putting, fixing, putting, digging, building, making lots of noise, and I think they really didn't enjoy that.
My son's a plumber, and the contractors that he worked with, these people don't, they don't walk into stuff like this and go, oh, it's, ooh, spooky. They're going, oh, I got a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
So these are very real people who got ran out because of the stuff going on
in there. Yeah, they're not expecting that. And that up until then, people just called it spooky because it was big and empty. But they didn't really, as far as I know, at that time in 2004, I don't think that they were looking for it to be that.
We're talking with Marianne Podrasky, who's the local local psychic in St. Joe, and also she and her husband work with the Beatty Mansion and help to run it, and are also part of the process of keeping it, if you'll forgive the pun, alive. And what can we do at Beatty Mansion now? The fact that you and I are talking about this means that there is some public access to it. What's going on at Beatty Mansion now?
We do overnights. We are open for paranormal investigations. We're going to work on being a venue for hosting other things as well. We're looking to do weddings and all kinds of crazy things there. You'd be surprised who wants to get married in a haunted mansion.
But when you look at the excessive, like, or the success of the Belvoir Winery, which was an Oddfellows place and a children's home and a this and a that over the decades, and now weddings go on there left and right. It's cool.
Mm-hmm. People are intrigued by the history. This is one of Beatty is one of those places where you walk in and you really feel like you're not alone. I know everybody says that, but you really aren't. You can hear noises broad daylight. The first 5 minutes I was in the building, I heard humming, heard a woman singing. I saw shadows creeping up on the ceiling, goopy black shadows. We heard a man whistling as well. Lots of footsteps, multiple people in conversation. And the thing is, it's like different layers. Like, people will be talking at one end, but then there's children down there. So it's just chock full, and I think that they interlap. I think that sometimes they're coming from their own time periods and hanging out with the other people, too. Because energy is attracted to energy.
Right.
And when it's deposited that way, it's
it sticks together, basically. It's like magnets, it comes together.
You're right. It's drawn to it. And we've got a project going on now that I think has really amped up the paranormal aspect. It's been called a home for the unwanted. So we've decided we would take all these vintage and antique pictures of people that we've found all over the place. Some of them in barns, old photo albums, and vacant, torn down houses. So we've been hanging all their pictures everywhere.
Oh my gosh!
And
that's
we've been giving the homeless pictures a home, just like the people were at one time.
You know, what's funny about that, and you and I had not talked about that previous to recording this, I love going through antique stores and especially junk, J-U-N-Q-U-E shops, and the first thing that I'm drawn to if I pass a booth is if it's got a basket full of pictures, because I'm looking for the stories within those pictures, and I've bought so many that, you know, I don't know these people at all, but you look at this picture and there's a story there. There's something unique about it, whether it's the expression, whether it's what they're doing.
There's something behind their eyes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They're
like
still talking to you.
Eye contact, it's like, don't forget me, don't forget me. And it bothers me that they're laying in dirty boxes and abandoned, and I feel like they need to be given a home. I've been really working on trying to find out who actually lived there at different periods.
Oh, yeah.
Finding names is just almost impossible because there was a fire and a flood at the courthouse, and
the
blueprints for the house are gone. All the census information, there's so much you can't find. You can find a lot online, but there's a lot you can't. And it's my goal to start putting the names on each room
of
the people that live there, naming the rooms after the people that live there, and honoring the ones who came and went, and those who didn't.
Yes, those who are still there.
Yeah.
That's the Beatty Mansion, B-E-A-T-T-I-E. It's historic and haunted in St. Joseph, Missouri. Be sure to go on to thebeattymansion.com. You can book the place and up to 5 guests. And then if you want more than 5, there's a very small charge for that. And check-in time, 5 o'clock. Check-out time the next day at noon if you don't end up checking out earlier because of what you get to experience and get to know during the night. Real quick, what is probably the strangest thing you know of that has happened there during a person's visit, whether it's a group or whether it's a single investigator? What is probably the oddest story you heard?
The dumb waiter running on its own. And it's been screwed shut for decades. It's been screwed shut for decades. And it started just recently running on its own.
Which is
pretty cool, really.
And that was also on A House on the Hill. That was on Netflix. I just bumped out a little bit. So,
oh, my God. Now I got to see it.
So the Beatty Mansion, that is thebeattymansion.com. You can also call 816-261-6678. And check it out. Talk to Mary Ann and her wonderful husband who are helping to keep the building up, to restore it. But when you go in, just be ready because this is a building in kind of its natural state, and you're gonna feel stuff
when you walk in. It's its own time capsule, really. It really is. And it's addicting. people who come in always want to come back. That's what keeps me coming back.
So, Marianne Podrasky, thank you for joining us here on Sideways Boulevard and sharing about the Beatty Mansion.
Well, thank you.
The amount of knowledge walking down these corridors, gentleman by the name of Carter Bouchart,
yep.
Who has written at least two books and who knows how many articles, etc., about Bigfoot, about cryptids, about the Sasquatch. And more reports seem to be coming in, and I think it might be the fact that people are feeling more able and more safe to share such things because of people like Carter Bouchart. Let's find out his story and what's going on with the big hairy guy. Carter, welcome to Sideways Boulevard.
Well, thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
Now, walking down the hallway, you and I had a wonderful conversation yesterday, and you've shared with me your book, Sasquatch, Evidence of an Enigma, and this is book two.
Yes.
And the first book, what's the name of the first book?
It's a Sasquatch, Evidence of an Enigma, one. It started out Sasquatch, Evidence of an Enigma, when I decided to do a second edition of that. I gave it the number. So it's Sasquatch Evidence of an Enigma 1, and this book is Sasquatch Evidence of an Enigma 2, and it was actually a smaller book, and now I've got a bigger book, so they're both got two editions.
Fantastic.
And so the next book, if I do a third, will be Sasquatch Evidence of an Enigma 3.
Now, before we dive into the books, let's talk a little bit about what even brought you around to doing this. We went into a bit of a deeper discussion, which is something that I want to share about the safety of being able to talk to people about your own experiences. But what brought you into this? What made you so focused and into the Sasquatch realm and to sharing this with the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, like probably many in my generation, a baby boomer bracket, I saw In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, and that got me drooling. And in later years, I went to Washington State with my wife on a week just camping in the woods, and I ran into a geocache box. I don't know if you're familiar with that game.
Yes.
And I thought I had stumbled upon a drug stash. I was in the forest. I thought I had it was in a big ammo box. I got the courage to open it up, and in that box was a card of a Bigfoot investigator from Washington. I said, I've always wanted to do this. I'm going to call this guy. I called him. He put me in touch with a researcher here in Missouri. I went on an expedition. I said, I want to be an investigator. What do I got to do? And you basically have to show an aptitude and a discerning mind, and you'll go somewhere. And so I paid my dues for 6 months. 14 years later, I've led four expeditions.
14 years.
Yeah, yeah. I've led four expeditions for BFRO, three in Missouri, one in Illinois. I've had over 100 reports published to BFRO.net. I've interviewed probably 400 people.
What's BFRO?
Bigfoot Research Organization, Bigfoot Field Research Organization, BFRO.
That is awesome.
It was just weird, and it's worked out incredibly well. The stories I'm hearing and the people I'm meeting have just been fabulous.
Now, as you go out looking, are you looking for evidence, or you know they're out there, you just want confirmation? Or tell me about kind of the things when you go on one of these expeditions, what you're gathering and what you're pulling in.
Yeah. Well, when I'm leading a public expedition, I have certain areas I don't cover, because BFRO is kind of a closed-minded organization as far as paranormal things go.
Right.
So I know they're out there. When I take them to a certain area, I have scouted that area heavily. I've been there probably a week before anybody gets there. I've scouted it. I know where to go, where I don't want to go.
Right.
And I'm looking for structures, footprints, knocks, any kind of communication, anything that I can share with these people, because they're coming on an expedition, they're curious, and they want to experience something. And I tell them right up front, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to have any kind of experience.
But oh, yeah.
It's an educated guess on my part that we're in the right spot to have the right, you know, environment for a potential, you know, interaction.
Okay, one of the things you just mentioned is I'm not familiar with. Tell me what a knock is.
Wood knocks. When you hear, very often you'll hear what sounds like a log being hit against a tree. Clock, clock, clock. Uh-huh. Sasquatch will knock on trees to communicate with other Sasquatch.
No kidding. I had no idea. Okay. Oh, this is... I am about to launch into some serious learning here. So with the Sasquatch, you know, I always thought it was just kind of that call out,
no,
but...
No, there's a lot more than that. They will do rock clacks. They'll clack rocks together. Some of these wood sounds, and I'm of the opinion that it's not always a tree on tree. It could be chest popping. So it sounds like a wood knock because some of these knocks are so clear and crisp. And if it's a rainy night, the odds of finding two dry pieces of wood to bang together are not really great.
Yeah.
So they could do it with their vocal cords. Cheek popping. You know, it's some of it is simian behavior, ape behavior.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. What are some of the other things that you look for? There was, like, in your book, Evidence of an Enigma, too. As I was paging through it, there were some shots of logs with stones piled on them and this and that. Mm-hmm. What am I looking at there?
That is one of the most... That was a big turning point for me, although I'd had one in 2013 that kind of got me on the path. But this...
Oh, yeah,
log,
it's right on the front page,
yeah,
as a matter of fact.
This log, there are six rocks here. I led an expedition. This is in Illinois. There was only four people on the expedition and my partner who lives in Illinois. Well, he has had a stroke and cancer. He's an elder gentleman. And so he couldn't go all the way down these ravines we were walking at night. So
right.
He stayed in the car. The next night we went down there, he stayed back in camp because he was just too worn out. So these five rocks here, this rock here, this long pointed one, the arrowhead looking, that's me, the leader.
Uh-huh.
These are the four expedition goers. This is Harold, who was there but not there.
So we're looking at, it's a log that's laying on the ground, and on one end there's a long pointed rock that Carter was talking about, and then there's three rocks next to it, and then one up above those, so you've got four rocks total. And then on the far end of that log is the other one.
It's the one rock that represents Harold. Now, Harold is kind of short and squat.
Uh-huh.
I'm tall and skinny. This is a nice, round, short, squat rock.
Oh, I didn't even catch that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, 2 years later, I go back. Here's what happened. When I saw this, uh-huh, I didn't pick up on it right away. I had to think about it. And how I know this represented us is that we had been down in this ravine two nights in a row. And so I thought, well, just for the heck of it, I'm going to leave a trail cam here, see if I get any shots, because we had some action,
right,
activity. So I'll see if I get anything on my trail cam. So the next morning, we left there about midnight. I went back the next morning at 8 o'clock as I was leaving to come back to Kansas City. This log is right by my camera. These six rocks were not there the night before. They appeared overnight. It completely coincides with the five people I was leading, these four people, and this is Harold, who was there but not there. It was just, I got the chills when I saw it. I had to trying to talk myself out of it, but they were memorializing the fact that we were down there by putting, we know you were here, here's these five rocks, and then one at the end.
I'll be doggone.
2 years later, I go back. Harold was able to go with me this time.
Uh-huh.
He had healed up from his injuries. And it's in another book. It's in the larger version of this. On this log here, these rocks are gone. This rock here is here.
So the one of him on the far end is now put back to where the other rocks were. That was,
yeah, and those
the
rocks
collection
are gone.
Of you guys. I'll be doggone.
And it's
now, does that fall under the communication or gifting?
A little of both.
A little of both. Okay, because on the cover of your book, you've got a list of things that you that are within the book.
Mm-hmm.
Communication, gifting, real events, infrasound, quantum and other theories, denial of existence. It's a book that covers a whole lot of territory mm-hmm. in a single volume, and it's the second volume, so you can imagine what the first one's like. What communication is the clicking, the tree hitting, etc. Mm-hmm. What's gifting?
Gifting is where you will leave them a gift, like a bag of apples or some bananas or some food that they can't get in the forest. And they may in turn leave you a stack of rocks. They may leave you a dead mouse, a piece of a deer that's been killed.
I'll be done. It'll so just, it's kind of almost like a trade. You give me, I give you.
It's like a trade. It is. And if you have habituation site, where habituation is where people have lived on this property for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and they interact with them on a weekly or monthly basis. And they will gift things back and forth. Like I'm talking about rocks. Sometimes they're mice wrapped in grass.
Oh, how it is just, weird and cool.
Yeah, it's really cool, but it's also, it shows a sapient, sentient mindset. These right. are thinking, reasoning, feeling
beings.
They're not even creatures. Yeah. They're way past the apes. They're way past us, probably.
Well, looking at some of the info that you have on your table here, you're mentioning that you've led four public expeditions. The Sasquatch beings are very plentiful in Jackson and surrounding counties, as well as nearly all areas of the Mark Twain National Forest here in Missouri. So at your table, tell the story. You have an artifact there that I'll let you explain, mm-hmm. and then tell the story of how you got that.
That's a handprint, and that was taken here in Jackson County, Missouri, Green Valley, at a Green place Valley. Called Monkey Mountain. Yeah.
Notably named.
Yeah, right. And there are three Monkey Mountains in Missouri, one up in St. Joe, one here, and there's one out south.
Uh-huh.
And so, and there's all kinds of stories. Well, you have to be a monkey to be able to climb that mountain, so they call it Monkey Mountain. Or there was a circus train that crashed years ago, and the chimps escaped, and they bred, and blah, 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 blah. You know, this is the baloney. But my partner, who I squatch with regularly for safety and for, you know, bouncing things off of each other, he went out to Monkey Mountain one day. And uh-huh. he was following the same path where most of my reports here that have been published. And
uh-huh.
it's an area we've been many, many times. And he just happened to look down, and there was this handprint in the mud, clear as a bell.
Wow.
So he took the print.
It's massive,
yeah,
by the way.
It's 13 inches from the base of the palm to the tip of the middle finger. It has dermal ridges. The palm has dermal ridges. You can see in the book that they are blown up. I took it to an unnamed crime lab.
Uh-huh.
And after I dusted the prints and we took it and turned in the print cards,
right.
and they ran it through the database, deemed it to be not a fake, it's a real print, because the dermal ridges, you cannot fake dermal ridges.
Right.
It's like a fingerprint, but they're on the palms and the thumbs and the hands. So that's where the print came from. And the good thing is, when the policeman buddy of mine told me the results, he said, well, number one, whoever this is doesn't have a record, which is good.
Good, yeah.
And the second part, don't ever bring me anything like this again. I had to answer way too many questions. Because when you take a fingerprint card into a crime lab, you have to enter it into the database.
Oh.
And so he had a lot of explaining to do. And being a veteran law enforcement person, he explained his way out of it. I said, Don't bring this ever again. This is too weird. I don't know what it is. I don't know who it is. I don't want to see him. If I run into him, I don't want to see him. So
it's abominable.
Yeah.
Well, that leads us actually kind of nicely into the next thing, which is as the on-site investigations and research person for Relic Hominid Investigations and Research. One of the things that you have allowed or that you are fostering and hoping to encourage is that people can contact you and or your group
mm-hmm.
to talk about these experiences.
Yeah.
Because it is so hard in a public forum and especially in workplaces, et cetera, to say, hey, I had this thing happen. So tell me a little bit about that and your experiences with people, especially here in Evidence of an Enigma 2.
Yeah.
Your book has a lot of these stories. How did you gather them, and how did you foster that openness?
Well, when I wrote the first book, Enigma One, is basically kind of a start to finish if you know very little or just a or something about Sasquatch. And I go through the whole thing where they where they're speaking, the gibberish, the counting, tree knocks, stick structures. I go through the whole thing. And as I get into some of my published reports, I started hearing from people that said, I've got something, but everyone laughs when I tell you this. So can I tell you this? I said, you're going to tell me that you just saw a Sasquatch and you have something even better to tell me? Bring it on. And so these paranormal events started rearing their head and said, I can't talk to anybody about this stuff because they make fun of me. My wife makes fun of me. My husband makes fun of me. My coworkers, I'm ridiculed. And so I just, I don't talk to anybody anymore.
I just clam it up.
Then you sit on it for years. You get upset. You're holding in information. It's like PTSD. So people started hearing me on podcasts and they said, I want to talk to this guy because I will listen to what you have to say. I'm not judgmental. I just listened to them and it just turned into an avalanche. And when I did the first book and was doing the podcast tour back then, these people came out of the woodwork. And so they filled up a second book.
If you've got your own Sasquatch story, or you need to, you want to contact somebody about some type of event or things that you've found that you're curious about, Carter is a person that it is safe to talk to. And if you send an email to sqexplorer@gmail.com, sqexplorer@gmail.com, Carter or an associate will be glad to contact you, to talk to you, to hear you.
Yeah, and it's all confidential. We don't use names or locations unless it's a public place, but we will never use your name. I use all my books, they're fictional names and fictional locations because those are not important.
Names What's are important changed to protect the innocent.
It is just the event.
Yes.
Because that event could happen anywhere. So who's in it and where it's at is not as important as the event itself. That's all we want to get out.
And this is the kind of spirit that's going on right here, if you'll forgive the pun, at the KC Spirit and Paranormal Convention. Carter, thank you so much for taking some time out, because I know it's been a cray day, and wonderfully so. And all across, it's a whole lot of people who've come together just to figure things out and to try stuff. And even if you have, you know, if you're completely new to stuff like this, it's a great time. These conventions, the KC Spirit and Paranormal Conventions, are super to come out and just test the waters.
Yeah.
See what's there. Talk to people. And that's one of the best things, like us right now, talking about things and discovering. So it's your chance. Now, remember, if you have had a Sasquatch experience or think you might have, sqexplorer@gmail.com. Carter Bouchard, thank you so much for joining us today on Sideways Boulevard.
Thanks for having me, Mark. It's been great.
We've been waiting for this one all morning for a chance to finally get together and to have just a few minutes because it is so busy. There's so much going on here. Gene M. Walker is the section director for KC MUFON, which we'll talk about here in a second. It's Star Team Investigator, author of Family Secrets. Now, Gene is also an educator and speaker. You can find her website at Gene Walker, Gene M. Walker.com. Gene, the fascinating thing that drew me to your table, there is you've got some cool alien art looking artifacts, etc. And you wrote a book. What is the name of your book?
Family Secrets.
On the cover, there is that a gray?
Yes.
Tell me, okay, we're going to give away your hook right here because I know there's tons of stories in this book. But if there's family secrets and there's a gray on there, Gene, what is this? What's the family secret?
Well, the family secret is I believe abductions and paranormal psychic type events and happen in families, whether it's through DNA, I don't know, hereditary. Perhaps, but the book is about mainly my family and about my abductions throughout my lifetime.
Now, you put an S on that. We're not talking your abductions.
Many.
tell us about, if you can share that without giving too much away from the book, because we definitely want you to go out and find that book and buy it, or stop by here and grab it. Tell us about your first abduction and how...
My very first memory in life is laying in my crib and seeing this horrid face, and it scared me to death, just terrified me. And I was screaming at the time. I remember... It's the only memory I have that young to be still in the crib. And I, as I aged, I couldn't figure out what that was.
But that stuck with you. It was glued in.
Yes, and you're right. And then I finally figured it out. Before I wrote the book, that was an alien. And I feel like they picked me from the crib because they knew what they were going to use me for breeding. Uh-huh. And so I think they picked me to do that. And that's why I was so horrified. And
oh, I would bet that you know, to suddenly realize that and face something like that, especially with individuals like what's on the cover of your book, that would be a hard thing to address. Mm-hmm. Now, for their purposes, were they successful?
Yes, they followed me throughout my lifetime. And when I was like 9-10 years old, I would see what I called the spaceman, and he would hide behind, like we had a barn in the back. Everything was country where right. I grew up, and we had a pond back behind the house too. And that spaceman, as I called him, and I called him that because he had a silver suit on. Uh-huh. And I can't for the life of me remember what the face looked like. So it must have really terrified me. But he was back there watching me all the time.
Ugh.
And I knew it was going to be taken. Of course, I didn't know it was aliens. I mean, I didn't know anything about aliens then. I just knew I was being watched. And I told my parents, I was so scared that whoever they were, was going to take me. And I remember my dad saying one time, maybe we should put iron bars on Jeannie's, because I had 2-bedroom windows, and that might make her feel safer.
Right.
But it wouldn't have helped, but I didn't realize then what was going on.
And it's just your dad trying to help you through what he would just see as a time and help you feel safer. Now, not to make light of your situation, but the only person in silver that I ever wanted to mate with was in ABBA. So that one's easily definable, and there were bars on my window, but that was to keep me inside. So so you went through such a traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. What led you to write a book about all this and share this with the public? Because I would think that it's so deeply personal, that would be a hard thing to do.
Well, I'm going to back up just a little here. When I got into my early 20s, I had 4 miscarriages. And they were not normal miscarriages. Like the first one, I passed after birth, but there was no fetus.
Right.
So what happened to the fetus?
Oh, okay.
And then the fourth pregnancy, I'll just skip over to the fourth one, I made it further than any. I usually lost them between 3 and 4 months.
Oh, heartbreaking.
The fourth month, I went to the doctor for my general checkup, and he said, Jean, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the baby's not growing anymore. Well, I was devastated because I didn't have any children. So I was pretty upset. And he says, but your uterus is too large to do a DNC on. He said, so I want you to go home a couple of weeks and let's see if your uterus doesn't go down, and then we'll do a DNC. So I said, okay. I went back in 2 weeks. And he said, there's nothing there.
What?
And I go, what do you mean there's nothing there? I made it further this time than I ever made
Doctor,
it.
Doctor, you are fired.
and he said, his answer, because I don't think he knew what to tell me. And he right. told me, well, nature has a way of taking care of these things. So what did it do? Dissolve in me at 4 months? I mean...
Wow.
And I tell in my book how I know these weren't just normal right. miscarriages, is my point here.
Right.
They also took my brother's sperm, and he remembers it.
Oh.
I have that in my book. We had many strange paranormal things that also happened to us. And my great-grandmother was a well-known psychic here in Kansas City back in the 50s. And
okay.
she'd be on the radio and take phone calls. And
right.
And she did a lot of things. And I have all that in my book, too. And some of the things she did were kind of comical.
Oh,
and
sure.
With her you know, abilities. And so I named it Family Secrets because I think it runs in families.
That is fascinating. So this is not... And that just totally expanded my whole view of this, because it wasn't just you experiencing and then the family understanding, which is so nice that they were supportive. But however, if it's happening to everybody, they got to be supportive because we're all in this.
Yes.
Holy cow. Tell a little bit about your grandmother. What was it? And about the show and her reach with Kansas City.
Well, she didn't have a show, but she'd be interviewed by different radio people, and she wanted to help people with her ability. When she was real young, they knew there was something real different about her, and they called her, her name was Nettie, and they called her Crazy Nettie.
Aww.
Because back then they didn't understand these abilities, you know, that she had, and they looked at her as being weird and different.
Oh, sure.
And even though she was my great-grandmother, she passed when I was 9, but I remember her so well because she was so different. You know, really.
Now, did she also do the different kind of dressing thing and had a more flamboyant flair to her?
No, or? She really didn't. She lived with her daughter, which was my grandmother.
Right.
And both of them were widows, and they raised my dad together.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah, and so growing up, my dad would tell stories about how she would do things. She could levitate this heavy walnut table in the dining room, and my grandmother swears there were no tricks to it. She did this on her own, and she would help people find lost items. And my dad was shot down over Germany in the war, World War II, and he was prisoner of war for 9 months. So for 9 months, they didn't know if he was dead or alive. And my grandmother, this house had those big old wooden oak doors that would slide shut. Pocket doors, yes. And she went in, closed herself in, and she told her daughter, my grandmother, don't bother me no matter what happens. Do not bother me. She was in there for 3 days with nothing to eat. And she... she was in a trance.
Yeah.
And she was trying to see if my dad, which she idolized, that was her grandson.
Oh, yeah. Was still alive and still with us.
And she come out and she said, he's here. He's alive. He's still with us. She says, and I see him. And I see him walking with a tin pan across barbed wire in front of him.
Yeah.
And she said, he's alive. And she says, he has a happy message for us. Later, I see him running. My grandmother had big steps that led up to her house, quite a few.
Right.
And she says, I see him running up those front steps with good news. Well, my parents had been married 7 years, no children. And when my dad got home from war, my mother got pregnant.
Oh, yeah, pretty quick.
With me.
You're a celebration, baby.
And my dad was running up those steps going, Mom, Grandma, Marie's pregnant. She saw the whole thing, though,
way
before it happened. Yeah, stories.
I have, getting to know my sister better, my mother passed away not that long ago, and my sister and I have had a lot more discussions and conversations, and I've learned a lot more about my grandmother than I ever thought I would know. And one of the things, because I, to be bluntly honest, my grandmother was amazing. She spoke in tongues, but usually it was after a six-pack of Black Label beer. So it made Thanksgiving dinner real interesting when Meemaw was down. But be that as it may, my sister had a much closer relationship with her. And there, it's just been in the past, you know, month that my sister's told me some stories. And I'm like, that's kind of amazing. So these familial connections that get passed down through generations and through bloodlines is amazing. Now, I am sorry that whoever these grays were decided that whatever your bloodline or DNA smelled like was like, yeah, we got to talk to those people. But the fact of your abilities and your grandmother's abilities is just fascinating. Now, tell me a bit about MUFON. What is MUFON and what do you do?
MUFON is Mutual UFO Network. And it's an international organization, so it's all over the world. It's huge. And they have a website. You just type in MUFON.com.
MUFON.com.
And if you see something, you report it to them, and then they'll send out a state investigator of where you've seen it, and we investigate, and that's what I do.
The one other thing I wanted to touch on before we get back to our tables and get back to enjoying the convention here today is you and I had a nice chat yesterday about the Joplin Spook Light.
Oh, yes. That's in my book, too.
Tell everybody about your experience with the Joplin Spook Light.
Well, I had a good friend, girlfriend, that lived down in Seneca, Missouri, and she was married, and we went down to visit my husband and I, and...
When was this about?
About the late 60s.
Okay.
And so, her growing up there, she knew all about what to do and where to go and the best place to see the spook light.
Yeah.
So, her sister and her husband went. So, we was in a 56 Chevy with the old bench seats.
Oh, yeah. Those are just rolling couches, people.
Yeah, they were.
That's all they are. I won't kid you. I had a 55 Plymouth. Oh, my. So, anyway, you're going out to see the quote-unquote Joplin spook light.
Yeah, so there was the three girls in front seat and the three men rode in the back seat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And we went down this lonely road. There was just nothing on it, trees, and back in the forest, you know.
Uh-huh.
We finally came out of the forest a little bit, and it was on a kind of like a dead end there because there was a big cliff, and you were overlooking these fields down below.
Okay.
So there was the old museum to our right that used to be there.
The Hornet, Spooklight Museum. Oh, my God.
Okay,
you actually got to see it. Yeah, I've read about it and seen pictures of it. But
it wasn't open. It had been deserted for a while, and the sign was hanging.
Oh, wow.
I've got that in my book,
I have watched movies that you've just described.
Yes.
None of them end well.
Well, that particular road's not even there anymore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the whole area has changed so much.
So
but you guys are looking over this and looking across these fields.
So I see these fields down below, and my friend, she tells me that they used to go on hay rides down there, and the spook light would chase them on these hay rides, which really added to the hay rides.
Oh, I'll bet.
You know, especially around Halloween. And so she said, now you can't talk, you can't make any noise, and we will see the spook light. And sure enough, we hadn't sat there too long. We were all quiet. Here comes the spook light. It was down in that field, and it was bouncing all around down in that field.
Oh, wow.
And then all of a sudden, it started coming towards our car. And to me, this light seemed like it had an intelligence of its own.
Uh-huh.
Because that was quite a distance to travel.
Yeah.
And how did it know that we were sitting there? Go straight from bouncing down in those low fields to come up to where the car was on this cliff. It came up to the front of the car, and it was about the size of a basketball.
Mm-hmm.
It was very bright, but as you mentioned, even though it was bright, it didn't hurt your light.
Yeah,
eyes,
it didn't burn
I
your
mean,
eyes, yeah.
You could see it. And so as it came across this big, long hood of this car,
uh-huh.
It got up to the window. I started screaming like crazy because it scared me. I thought that light was going to come in and burn me or hurt me or do something. You know?
It's a ball of light, for God's sakes, and it's coming at you. That's a little scary.
Yes. So as soon as I started screaming, that light, poof, it was gone.
Oh, so like she'd said earlier, don't make a sound. But when you started, I'll be doggone.
Yeah, when I started screaming, it disappeared, and we didn't see it again. So we left shortly after that. I was glad.
Show's over. Yeah, I bet you were. I'm a little dry. Hi, guys. A little dry. Take me home. Well, that's the Joplin spook light, and we'd shared a story because my mother had seen it up close back in the 50s also, and is one of the cherished memories for me of her telling the story. And a lot of people have seen it here and there. Not that many right up close. So that makes it unique. And her, it was fun when we were talking about it yesterday, because when I was describing my mom's description, mm-hmm. your eyes lit up.
Yes.
You're like, that's exactly it.
Yes.
And yeah, basketball-sized ball of light that's super bright but doesn't blind you when you look right into it. So all of this is in this book, Family Secrets. And again, you can find it on Amazon.com or at GeneMWalker.com. And Gene, it has been a pleasure talking to you. I know you've got a million things to do right now with the convention and also at your table. And if you can see the table, it's so much fun. There's so much cool stuff to purchase there.
I've got a lit up alien.
I know, right? Of course you do.
Yes.
and it is so cool, and it is such a pleasure to have finally gotten a chance to talk to you. Thank you for joining us here on Sideways Boulevard.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
Again, many thanks to April and Bettina from KC Spirit and Paranormal for allowing us to be there to sell books and to talk to cool people about cool stuff. Had such a great time. KC Spirit and Paranormal will be having an event in Branson, Missouri, and also another event in fall in Kansas City. They're just going to keep on rocking and rolling, so keep an eye on their Facebook page. That's KC Spirit and Paranormal. And thank you for listening to Sideways Boulevard. We're three Kansas City horror authors who love to get together and research and talk about some really unique stuff. Be sure to check out our Facebook page, look us up on Twitter, and at some point, I promise, I'll get a website going. I've just really sucked at it so far. So thank you for listening. We'll see you next time here on Sideways Boulevard. According to Ozark legend, someone who's been cursed by witchcraft can leave a black button lying on the road. If you should pick it up, you'll get more than you bargained for. You see, if you take the button, you also take the curse. Welcome to the Black Buttons Dark Fiction Anthology Series, published by Magnificent Cowlick Media and available on Amazon.com. All stories involve the tone and the terror of the Midwest. Turn the page in Black Buttons and discover that all is not right where the Bible Belt buckles. Black Buttons, Volume 1, Volume 2, and Volume 3, available now on Amazon.com. Go ahead, if you dare. Pick up Black Buttons, because you're not afraid of some old superstition, are you?
Are you?